This is Audible.
Amarillia, Book 4, New Horizons. Written by Michael Chatfield. Read by Tristan Morris. Chapter 1. 6 months. Anna looked out of the keep's tower and saw Devil's Crater. She had been there nearly every other week, with Induka or Malsor coming with her to speed up the travel time between the Aleph's hidden teleport pad and the demon's home. Malsor and Fornow had started the basics of the valley. Fornow had marked out an area for the city that would rest in the middle of the crater. Fields had been created, and a lumber mill sat in the middle of the northeastern forest, with a number of mines opened. Homes made of polished stone had been raised near the farms, the hunting forests, and the lumber mill. While Malsor had repaired all the keeps, Alkaus was still the only one which had been covered with metals. He'd also built an 8th keep to distance them all apart and watch over the surrounding lands. Unless you knew where the keeps were, they were hard to see. Malsor's work made them look like part of the cliff they grew from. Anna looked into the crater, watching as farmers were working their fields. Fornow had been gracious enough to bless the ground, ensuring that it would remain fertile for a long time to come. His touch could be seen across the crater, and while he had to return to Quindar and their hatchlings, he promised to return. Anna heard a flap of wings. She looked over to see Alkau swoop down toward the balcony she stood on. He landed easily, walking as soon as he touched down, wearing simple clothes, and caring less about appearance and more about form, he wore the weapons Dave had gifted him with pride.
"Anna, I did not know that you would be here today."
Alkau smiled. Her chest tightened. Over the last 6 months, they had worked long nights and longer days to make sure the Devil's Crater would be ready for the return of their people, and to make sure that their alliance would work. She had come to see him as not only a brilliant warrior, but a man who was coming to understand his shortcomings and was looking to do the best by his people. She saw the stress that wore on them both, and they'd become close. Often, Anna had thought about becoming even closer. She put her feelings down to the stress weighing on them and pushed them aside. "I was able to get the day off from raiding," Anna said.
"One day I hope that you tell me how you get here so fast," Alkau said.
"Maybe one day," Anna shrugged, continuing to look out over Devil's Crater, while watching Beastkin and demons who were working together at the lumber mill and checking on the growing orchard and planting fields. They had been getting reports, sent through the incoming villagers and supporting demons and Beastkin, on the progress of both sides. As the stigma of being a non-combatant disappeared, several demons had left the army, having been shown by their Beastkin allies that a farmer was a necessary component for any community. The Beastkin had shown them that a farmer was as useful, if not more useful, than 50 demon warriors. They had taken the demons and turned them from a fighting rabble to a semblance of a military. Order was created. Duels for advancement were banned. Medical treatment and fighting tactics were adopted. Although on Amarillia, 6 months had passed since Kala and her Beastkin had started to teach the demons, it had been 9 months for the nameless planet Bob had placed them on.
"It is almost time," Alkau said after a few minutes.
Anna looked at her friends list. A number of names of her Beastkin friends were there, but she couldn't call them up directly. The distances were too great for her private messaging system to reach. "I'm looking forward to seeing how the demons have changed," Anna said.
"So am I."
Alkau paused, as if thinking something over.
"After they arrive, will you continue to come back?"
He looked to her, his face stony. While he was prepared for her to say no, he really hoped she wouldn't.
"I will."
Anna smiled at his relief.
"Good. My brothers might be good demons, but there is something refreshing about having a female member on the council."
"I will take that as a compliment," She laughed and moved for the keep's door. Alcau followed her into the barely furnished command center. The Devil's Crater map had been updated, and there were also maps and information off to the side, detailing the advance of the Dark Lord's demon horde. They had decreased in numbers as they moved toward Devil's Crater. Infighting and their constant hunger made them more rabid after a few weeks of not killing. By their rate of advance, they would arrive in 2 months. It didn't seem that the Dark Lord knew that his rebelling first demons had already returned to the crater, something that Alcau and Anna were going to take advantage of. Anna and Alcau stepped out in front of the keep and looked over the expansive interior. A handful of DCA guards kept watch. Alcau had requested villagers and non-warriors first, to give the warriors more time for training, and allow the beastkin to beat more information into the demon warriors' heads. Anna and Alcau stopped at the entrance. Anna took the opportunity to check her interface's clock. She looked to the open area once again. 500 demon and beastkin warriors appeared, their leaders standing in front of each square formation. Anna's hand went to her blade at the suddenness of it all, and the eerie quiet of the 500 men and women in front of her. A big bear human walked out of formation and came to stand in front of Alcau and Anna. "Captain Kala, Prince Alcau, I present the 1st Regiment. The other regiments are being moved to the different fortresses with their commanders. The rest are being placed down within the city. We await your orders," Kala said. Anna and Alcau looked out over the forces in front of them. They wore a variety of weapons and clothes, looking like a rabble. However, the way they were formed up, the look in their eyes, it spoke of hardened fighters who had been formed into a singular disciplined fighting force.
"Captain Kala, have 2 companies remain here to take over duties of the keep. As for the rest, we have a number of fields that need labor."
Alcau's eyes flickered to the battalion behind her.
"As you command."
Kala nodded her head slightly, before she turned and headed back to her battalion to issue her orders. A slow, hungry smile passed over Alcau's face, seeing that not one of the demons looked annoyed or voiced their anger at being used to help on the farms. "Something funny?" Anna asked.
"No. I'm proud. Proud that my people were able to come this far. If they can handle being treated like simple farmhands, then they'll have the discipline in battle to fight together. I thought that 2 months might not be enough time to get the crater ready. Now I don't feel so nervous. I feel excited. In 2 months, we'll show the Dark Lord and his minions the true power of the demons and beastkin."
Alcau looked at her with a proud expression. Anna turned to watch as 400 demons and beastkin turned and marched out of the keep, headed into Devil's Crater. The remaining companies came together for a quick briefing before heading about their newly assigned duties. Kala walked back over to Anna and Alcau.
"I was thinking, at the rate Bob was going, it would be 2 years before he told you he had us out of the ice."
Kala clapped forearms with Anna before they brought each other into a deep hug. They hugged for a moment before pulling away.
"It was only a few days, you big complainer," Anna laughed.
"He didn't tell you."
Kala scratched her head awkwardly.
"What?"
Anna asked.
Well, we've been awake for a few months longer than the demons."
Anna closed her eyes and rubbed the bridge of her nose.
"Dad, you damn forgetful gnome!"
Anna yelled at the sky.
"So, you must be Alcau."
Kala ignored her outburst and clapped wrists with the demon prince, one of the few people who was taller than her.
"Captain Kala, I've heard good things from my brothers, and so far I've been impressed with how you have turned my demon hordes into a true fighting force. I think it is about time we talked about getting them proper weapons and armor,"
Alcau said.
"I like him. Can we keep him?"
Kala looked at Anna, who was muttering to herself.
"Kala, he kind of rules this whole place."
Anna waved at Devil's Crater.
70%, Kala countered.
As per their alliance, Al-Kau was part of the ruling council, which was made up of the 7 demon princes and princesses, and 3 representatives of the Beastkin, Anna, Kala, and Edwin. Al-Kau, Malkur, Kaino, Lina, Aishox, Efri, and Gaula made up the demon side. Lina was Rexu's new wife. Both Rexu and Lazar had become generals, each leading 50,000 soldiers. Malkur, Efri, and Al-Kau were also generals. Kala had denied the rank of general, but Anna had been named as the 6th general.
"Congratulations are in order," Al-Kau said.
"Oh?"
Kala asked.
"On your new promotion," Al-Kau said.
"Well, I've been a captain for a while now,"
Kala said dryly.
"But now you're a major general. General Anna's second in command." Ignoring Kala's glare, Anna said,
"Look, you're the best qualified for it. I don't know why you didn't take the damn position already. So shut up and take the second spot," Anna said.
"Well, you get to go off and deal with other matters. It'll be like I'm in charge of it 80% of the time."
"Well, it's a good thing that I have such a competent second in command,"
Anna said, making it clear that there was no way Kala could get out of this. Kala snorted, still not happy, but going with it.
"Fine."
"Good. Then you can take over talks with Al-Kau about kit and weapons." "I have somewhere I need to be," Anna said.
"Just saw each other for the first time in centuries, and you're off again?"
"Lots to do, not much time to do it in," Anna smiled and hugged her friend. "I'll be back soon enough. Then we can start seeing what this lot are capable of." Anna nodded toward the demons and beastkin.
"I think you'll be pleasantly surprised,"
Kala said with a confident smile.
Feels like someone is cursing me."
A shiver went down Bob's spine.
"What would make you think that?"
the Lord of Water asked, as they sat in the Myrrh capital, playing 3-dimensional chess.
"No reason."
Bob made a quick move to get past the comment.
"So, how are your people liking the Mages Guild and Emerilia in general?"
"I was not sure if Fire would accept my alliance. I also thought that she would have used the power to improve herself. I did not think that she would feed it right into the mana pools of the College and Mages Guild. The more my people and I interact with her, the more I realize how blind I was. I knew that we were conditioned from birth to become the lords and ladies of the affinities. Yet each of us comes to the task in a different way. Dark and light crave power above all else. Earth demands respect from all. Air wishes to create mischief, while I just wish to see my children thrive, as Fire does with her dragons, and those who attend her schools. My anger and drive for more power made me hide under the seas and create the Merpeople. Over time, they changed me more than I changed them. I didn't wish for more power. I wished to help them grow."
The Lord of Water moved his piece.
"Checkmate,"
he smiled.
"What have you been doing down here? Playing chess the entire time?"
Bob complained, using the gnome form he'd started using nearly 2 years ago.
"Among other things,"
the Lord of Water smiled. It was hard for him to find a good opponent. Fire was his best by far, but Bob was also rather good at the game.
"So, what do you think of Fire's offer?"
Bob pushed his king over and admitted defeat. Water looked thoughtful as tendrils of water moved the pieces back into place.
"Become a teacher within the Mages College?
I must say I'm interested, and after a brief look at what information they have, I must say that I am interested to read more of their books."
"If you are to join the college, then you will have to accept the contract. It will bind your power to the Mages Guild as well as the Merpeople. You will no longer be able to access your divine pool that holds the mana devotions made by your followers. With only your personal power, your power will be greatly limited. The knowledge the Mages Guild has will assist you, but you'll need to work on your levels and stats to increase your strength,"
Bob warned. It is only recently that I have come to realize how much of a father you are. The Lord of Water smiled, making the first move.
Yeah, with some of the biggest and most powerful brats in the universe.
Bob sighed and moved his pieces out. I still haven't decided yet. I would like to, but I fear for the safety of my people and my person. Fire takes a great risk with walking across Emerilia. If one of the other Affinity's paladins found out where she was, they could kill her. It would be hard, but it would also be possible, the Lord of Water said.
Well, at least you recognize that you can die,
Bob said.
Few in the Pantheon believe such a thing is possible after living for so long.
They have never left the Pantheon or their various hidden strongholds.
They don't know the effect their games have on Emerilia.
To them, it is a game. Though recently I have felt new forces at play on Emerilia. Water moved his pieces, watching Bob closely.
Things are changing in a way that even I can't predict,
Bob said, following up Water's move. Water moved his pieces in silence. Bob had given him much to think on.
Chapter 2. End in Sight.
You damn cart!
Dave yelled. The wrench in his hands doubled in size, looking nearly as large as Steve's axe, and used it to hit the cart. It jumped slightly as Dave shook his head, seeming to give up its fight and shuddering slightly before moving backwards.
Ha! Take that!
Dave let the wrench go. It turned to smoke, revealing two rods that flew back to either side of Dave's belt. He tiredly rubbed his head. It had taken them 2 months to clear out the first phase/stage of the facilities, and 3 for the second, leaving them with just the final one to be completed. Based on the difficulty of getting the previous facilities working, Dave knew it was going to be a challenge. Dia walked through the refinery's catwalks, finding Dave sitting at a nearby empty workstation.
Hey, babe.
Dave looked to her with a weary smile.
What did the poor cart do to you?
She smiled, making Dave feel a little less tired as she gave him a side hug.
Got stuck.
Dave shrugged. The other crafters who had been sent to learn from the impressive Dave snorted and shook their heads, working on the varied maintenance issues that plagued their latest forge facility.
So you hit it with a wrench?
She asked, exasperated at her fiancé's antics.
No, I hit it with a bigger wrench.
Dave smiled, clearly pleased with himself.
First lesson of engineering,
adding quietly to himself,
although that's more mechanical than rocket.
So, other than beating the forge's carts into motion with a massive wrench, Dia gave him a pointed look, the corners of her mouth twitching.
How are we looking on repairs?
Well, the main smelting furnaces are back online, thanks to my runers.
Runers? Do you mean runners?
Dia said, giving him a confused look.
No, runers.
I'm still working on the whole naming thing, all right? Dave sighed. He might have come up with a new way of making magical circuits by writing it out like lines of code instead of magical formations. It made the whole process more refined, increasing the effectiveness of the magical coding and also reducing the necessary size that a magical circuit took up. But there had been a number of real-life coders who had taken the idea and gone nuts with it. Dave had dangled his book of magical runes, and now there were a number of them who tried to follow Dave everywhere to talk magic coding.
I think I'll keep to magical coding for now, Dave said.
So, progress? Dia asked. Those damn metal-munching rodents messed this place up pretty bad. We fixed the metal plating that opens into the magma chamber, regulating the forge's heat, fixed and filled the coolant tanks, which were either cold as hell or boiling hot. I actually gained vitality points just for doing it. Dave shook his head. Josh now only sent Dia and her party to where the worst damage or creatures were. Mostly, it was damage. With Dave's abilities, he could quickly diagnose and fix what would take several other people days or even weeks to do. The multiple different components on the factory side of the forge are messed up. We've put the repair bots on it, and we're shipping most of our materials out to the other forges. I hear that we're having trouble with raw ore supplies. Dave looked to Dia.
Yeah. Shard and Josh have asked us to go and take a look at one of the mines. The crafters are having a rough time of it. There is a large concentration of those ore-extracting machines in the mine's area. They have been extruding materials for decades, but there hasn't been anything to cut it back. The mine looks like it's half caved in, Dia said.
Awesome.
I guess this is what I get for not needing that much sleep anymore.
Something like that, Dia said.
Dave snorted and opened up a flashing notification.
You have gained a class level. Aleph Engineer.
Just making all kinds of things. For fixing Aleph tech, because it's confusing as hell and complicated, I'm surprised your brain could handle it, you get a whole nother class. Seriously? You think these things are trading cards or something? Damn well racking them up.
Status, level 2. Effects.
Plus 30 to endurance, willpower, and intelligence.
Woohoo!
Dave laughed, doing a small jig with a giant smile on his face. Others looked over before they shook their heads and got back to work. They were used to the dwarven halfling's excitable manner. Dave hummed out an upbeat song as he danced from side to side. Celebration over, Dave checked his character sheet. Character sheet. Name, David Gruslock. Gender, male. Level, 10. Class, Dwarven Master Smith. Friend of the Grey God. Bleeder, Librarian. Aleph Engineer. Race, Human Dwarf. Alignment, Chaotic Neutral. Unspent points, 511. Health, 12,100. Regen, 4.82 per second. Mana, 2,910. Regen, 12.95 per second. Stamina, 1,920. Regen, 9.35 per second. Vitality, 121. Endurance, 241. Intelligence, 291. Willpower, 259. Strength, 192. Agility, 187. Dave looked through his character sheet. It had all passed so quickly, going from one fight and fix to the next. Active skill. Archery. Level, Master, level 1. Effect, critical hit chance increases by 41%. Ranged targets take 22% increased damage. Cost, 10 stamina. Passive skill, dodge. Level, Master, level 2. Effect, 87% chance to evade objects. 10% faster when fighting more than two opponents. Passive skill. Perception. Level, Master, level 3. Effect, 91% chance to find hidden details. 15% chance at better loot. Active skill. Two-handed. Level, Expert, level 8. Effect, 38% armor penetration on target. Stamina costs reduced 15% while fighting. Cost, 35 stamina. Active skill. Dual wield. Level, Master, level 1. Effect, attacks are 41% faster. 5% chance of slowing target. Cost, 15 stamina. Active skill. Inference. Level, Expert, level 3. Effect, 69% increased chance of using moves you've read in books. Active skill. One-handed and shield. Level, Expert, level 9. Effect, weapons damage increased by 39%. Defense increases by 15%. Cost, 20 stamina. Passive skill, night vision. Level, Master, level 6. Effect, 95% increased night vision. 30% increased vision in magical darkness. Racial bonus. Dwarves, even half-dwarves, are at home in the darkness of mines and their empires dug underneath mountains. plus 25% increased night vision, plus 5% in magical darkness. Active skill. Sprint. Level, Master, level 5. Effect, 93% increased speed. Sprinting costs 25% less stamina. Cost, 5 stamina per second. Active skill. Sneak attack. Level, Master, level 2. Effect, when you are undetected in stealth, attacks will hit with 368% increased damage. Massive increase when hitting critical area. May your aim be true. Ignores 10% of opponent's armor. Cost, attack, 50 stamina. Active skill. Stealth. Level, Master, level 4. Effect, 91% chance to remain undetected. Reduced in direct light. 20% easier to detect others in stealth. Must be below your level in stealth. Cost, 5 stamina per second. Active skill. Spell formation. Level, Expert, level 7. Effect, you use 20% less mana, and your spells are 77% stronger. Active skill. Soulsmith. Level, Expert, level 5. Effect, 73% less soul energy necessary for crafting with Soulsmith. Cost, dependent on creation. Active skill. Builder. Level, Master, level 5. Effect, 93% speed and efficiency. Creation's material cost is reduced by 25%. Required, tools. Active skill. Smithing. Level, Master, level 4. Effect, 91% improved quality of smithing creation. 20% chance to imbue metal with skill. Able to analyze items made of stone, iron, steel, silver, malachite, gold, ebony, mithril, aluminum, and titanium. Active skill, soul manipulation. Level, Master, level 3. Effect, tools you make to manipulate souls and their energy are 89% stronger, able to use soul energy to fuel spells. 15% increase to soul energy's reserves. Can only be used for spells. Does not act as extra willpower points. Cost, dependent on creation. Active skill, magical circuits. Level, Master, level 9. Effect, 100% chance of creating better magical circuits and understanding them. 45% reduction of cost. Cost, dependent. Active skill, maintainer. Level, Master, level 1. Effect, 85% chance to restore durability. At higher levels, possible to increase durability, quality, and gain 10% sharpen bonus to items that have been cared for. Required, dependent on gear. Sharpening stone, hammer, anvil. Better maintainer's tools lead to higher chance of increasing stats. Dave had to just look around him and see all the repair bots that swarmed the badly damaged forge to know that these levels had paid off. They had started with just a handful. Now they had over 1,000 of the creations rushing around, repairing different systems and speeding up their ability to fix areas. There were also guardian automatons that they could call on to fight with them, greatly increasing the effectiveness of a Stone Raider's party. Each and every one of them had gained an aura detection skill, a kind of sixth sense that came from fighting hundreds of opponents. While the overall level gain might have been barely 30 or so, the Stone Raiders were nothing like their old selves. Their new or improved skills, instincts, and training for fighting nearly every day for 6 months had made them a powerful force. Josh was already joking about trying out Ashal's dungeons. Dave? Dia asked after a few minutes. Sorry, was somewhere else, he said. I noticed. First, you're getting some food, sleep, and then we can go to the mining facility, Dia said. I like that plan. Dave smiled. Dia stood. The two of them held hands as they waved to the other Stone Raiders. Dave had worked as hard as any of them for 2 days straight, He had been the only crafter capable of braving the heat of the forge while he fixed the coolant systems and the heat regulators. Malsor and Induka met them on the way, having taken the opportunity to change into their dragon forms. Dave and Dia talked about different things. Dia sent messages to the rest of their party. They had made it through the honeymoon phase, supporting each other in their pursuits. Dave in his crafting and Dia in her leadership. They'd become so close that they found it difficult to think of living without the other. "If I never see another metal-eating Odo, I'll be happy," Induka finished saying as she and Malsor talked. They fell in behind Dave and Dia, deep in conversation. "They are interesting beasts, using the planet's heat and mana to survive. The metals down here probably tasted better to them than the unrefined ores," Malsor said.
"Did you really have one carted off so you could open it up?"
"Their ability to manipulate inanimate objects, but only for the elements that they have bands on their bodies, is amazing. Those bands must take decades to build up. They're also highly refined and imbued with mana. I can only imagine what the dwarves are going to pay for that kind of material," Dave interjected. "What are you going to do with your share of the loot?" Susie asked, as they passed an automaton fighter that was sawing through an Odo. The Odo had a massive maw, with 8 clawed feet that jutted out like the points on a compass. They were meant to assist it through the ground as it consumed or pushed through anything in its path. It had a rigid body, from its massive mouth to its only slightly smaller posterior. Inside, the bands had highly acidic linings that broke down the metals. The bands had different colors depending on which metals they had consumed. Each band was only formed of one singular metal. Some Odo might have multiple bands of the same metals, or interspersed bands showing which metals the Odo had eaten through over time. The Odo could only manipulate the metal that they had bands of. The more bands, the more powerful. "Looks like a rigid toilet roll that's been pinched at one end and has feet sticking out of it," Dave said.
"So, kind of like a toilet roll, but not at all?" Susie quipped.
"I think the question is what to do with the loot," Dia said.
"Well, I'm going to keep it. I know that Susie had been looking for a staff of some sort, and I think that with the mana attunement, if you two want it, I think I can make you magical weapons, as well as Induka."
They would also be getting a large portion of mana-imbued mithril, ebony, and other rare metals from the Odos. No other party would be able to do anything but sell these expensive resources. With them, they looked first to improving themselves. Anything else, they threw out. It was the Stone Raiders' way. Dave already had requests from other Stone Raiders for custom work. Anna's sword had made them all eager to get a Dave-crafted weapon. "I would be interested in rings, primarily. A wand capable of holding a higher-level dark spell would also be nice," Malsor said.
"I have been holding off on new blades, though these ones' durability has been dropping quickly due to the higher-level buffs I am using with them," Dia said.
"I know I said a staff would be cool, but I'm more interested in heavy mana-imbued cores, especially for steel, which takes so long to get it to retain any kind of mana. It's the best metal to use for my creations," Susie said.
"Hi-ho, party," Steve said, waiting in the teleport room.
"Hey, Steve,"
Dave waved and yawned.
"We off to the mining facility?"
"Nope, food and rest. Some of us need sleep," Dia said.
"Okay. Mind if I go off to do some hunting with Dwayne, then?"
Steve asked as the teleport activated. They stepped through without a second thought. The teleport pads had become familiar long ago.
"Sure, just don't get too banged up," Susie warned as they walked out into an identical room.
They waved to the Stone Raiders waiting in the different control rooms on the second floor. Trap runes lined the room. If someone needed to fall back and brought something with them, either the traps or the different players would kill it before it could do much damage.
I'll be fine,"
Steve waved as if it would be an impossibility.
"You said that before I had to replace your leg. 3 days ago?" Dave said.
"How was I supposed to know that the damn log with legs would try to eat my foot?"
"When we said, get out of the way, you idiot, it eats metal.
I think it would be around that point,"
Susie nodded to herself.
Sorry, can't hear you. Automatons don't have ears, you know. Hey, Dwayne,
Steve said, looking at the party that was organizing. By their members and numbers, it looked as if it would be quite the battle.
Hey, Steve,
Dwayne looked to the rest of Party Zero.
Everyone else?
They greeted him as they headed out of the teleport room and into the central tower that had become their home. They headed into the mess, greeting different people before grabbing food and sitting down. A large open window showed the rest of the city that had become their home base after they'd liberated it from an army of the undead, a few moles, and a lich lord. It was shaped like a hollow cylinder to increase the available living space, which was only possible by the centrifugal force created by a gentle spin and gravitational runes along the floor. When they had arrived, the city had been in darkness. Only the tower that they had arrived in had any sort of power to it. Now, entire regions of the city were lit up as power stations, workshops, mining facilities, forges, and every major system had come online. Even with the lights coming online with different systems, the sheer scale of the city was still hard to understand. The lights barely illuminated the massive contained city. They talked about this and that, their plans for the materials, and then what they thought could be their next mission after the mining facility.
I think that it's going to be a combat mission,
Malsor said.
What makes you think that?
Susie asked, between bites of her burger.
We're finishing off all the maintenance issues and only going into the areas where there is little resistance.
I think that there is a large concentration in one or more of these last few facilities we need to clear, Malsor said.
I'm nearly at master with one-handed and two-handed. I hope we can get in enough trouble for me to level those up,
Dave said. Have you put thought into advancing to level 50 so that you can get another class? Dia asked.
Not just yet. I really want to try to go for the classes I know I can get on my own merits. Though being level 50 does have its benefits. It'd take a lot more deaths before I lost my classes, and the longer I stay at level 50, the more my body will get used to it. I think it's about time I started using those points. It takes me days of fighting just to get a few levels.
How long is it taking you to get skills, Suze?
It's slowing down by a lot, but if I was to try out fighting, I think that my stats would still increase for a bit. I think you're reaching the realm of diminishing returns. It's hard for you to gain any kind of stat points by just training, so you'll have to resort to using the stat points that comes with gaining a level to increase. What level are you, anyway?
Technically, I'm level 10 still, but I've unlocked level 113. Dave said.
How many stat points have you spent on your unlocked levels? Dia asked.
54. Malsor whistled.
That is a hell of a lot of stat points.
Dave opened his interface and pulled up his level. Level 113. You have reached level 113. You have 511 stat points to use.
You could say that.
How many stat points do you have already in your character sheet? Dia asked. Dave switched over to his character sheet, tallying it up. With his increased intelligence, he could easily remember multiple things, his memory becoming almost photographic. 1,291, which is the same amount as someone who is level 258. Dave took a moment for his brain to understand what he had just said.
Damn, Susie said. Looks like Josh might not have been joking about us being able to take on dungeons in Ashal. Dia said. I hadn't realized how strong we had all become down here.
All of them sat, lost in their own thoughts. Dave spread out his aura detection skill, checking the aura of all those around him. Few were trying to hide it. Some did it unconsciously. He used Malsor as a reference point, knowing that his actual aura was 10 times what he was letting out.
Damn, we don't look that much weaker. We're all about a tenth as strong as a dragon.
Dave had to wonder how powerful Malsor was compared to his fellow dragons. Knowing that Malsor had killed the undead Xalur demon lord at Borin Al's citadel made a hungry smile pass over Dave's face. People and guilds had been arguing that the Stone Raiders were dead, as they hadn't been seen in the longest time. They slowly grew in numbers and wealth, but never showed themselves.
Well, I think we're going to give the rest of Emerilia one hell of a shock when we finish helping the Aleph, Dave said.
Dia laughed and shook her head.
I don't think there has been a group of players this powerful so soon in the player's life cycle.
I foresee an interesting future, Malsor smiled.
Chapter 3 Welcome to the Guild. Lucy, Florence, and a dozen other guild members were having conversations about the supply and logistics situation of the clan. Many of the people in the room weren't even using the same mirror of communication. They'd taken them from the PKP, who'd had a bunch of them. Being such expensive items, they targeted other players who had them, using them as a status symbol. Florence had, also, quickly bought a number of the smaller mirror of communications that were much cheaper than their larger and farther-ranged mirrors, like the one Dave had secluded in his cedar. The Stone Raiders had discovered a large number of the mirrors wherever they were hidden, and had the Exdar's traders sell them off. In fact, a number of trade agreements had been advanced by offering a mirror at reduced cost to a governing person. Beyond just using them for their ability to safely meet face-to-face with their subjects and other rulers, they used them to display their wealth and power. Josh came through the door, walking over to where Florence and Lucy were talking about the next food and material shipment.
We're going to need some more alchemy ingredients as well, Lucy said.
How are you looking for meat? Florence asked.
We've got an agreement with some hunters for grade A meat.
Damn. That must be why that market terminal has been rating it as so expensive. Never had something so tasty.
Florence sighed.
Which brings me to those terminals. If we were able to use them and put them into every city and village, then charged even a 1% tax, we'd make a fortune. It would also mean that we wouldn't need to use the wagons so much.
Didn't you get the upgraded magical coating to improve their speed?
Ah, yes, we have. Though we're going to need better magical beasts to pull them. The Quadda are now too slow. I was thinking of heading to Ashal or Perouche to see what manner of beasts they have in order to increase our delivery speed.
You're by far the fastest distributors in Emerilia, and you want to go faster?
Lucy looked amused. You should know. The faster we are, the better the profits will be upon reaching our destination. Oh, we had the Archmage come and see us the other day. It seems that they want to come into a trade agreement with us. Seems that we are the most reliable and consistent suppliers of fine materials that they have had the pleasure of working with.
Most places don't sell as many high items as we do, or have such a stock of them.
Is that so? I wonder if it has anything to do with the terminal you have in your guild headquarters and being able to get anything worth selling in moments, Lucy said with a wry smile.
It might have something to do with that.
Florence tapped her chin and thought. If I was to tell them that, they'd probably want to pull it apart. Bino Bronx is always talking about the latest ancient artifact he bought and admired. He's getting a lecturer's spot at the Mage's College because of his knowledge. Did you know?
I didn't know that. Good for him.
Josh cleared his throat as he moved beside the desk the two ladies were talking to each other across. Their interfaces glowed like white windows off to the side.
Ah, Josh. How is it going?
Florence dismissed her screen.
Not bad. Planning out how to retake a housing complex that is filled with shambling mounds, cultists, and possibly a paladin.
Josh sighed, grabbed a chair, and sat down.
So, what did you need me for?
Well, Lucy and I have been talking, Florence said, as the both of them smiled as Josh looked between them. I know that the Stone Raiders and the Golden Sabers are looking to become an alliance. Our guilds have worked together for quite a while now. And I've been thinking that we should make it official, Florence said.
The proposal is that the Exdar's traders become a part of the Stone Raiders.
Florence would take over my position as quartermaster, allowing me to look toward my support of the Stone Raiders instead of the supply situation, Lucy said.
As well as your spies.
Josh held his chin in thought. There were a number of benefits. By removing the middleman, profits would increase. Some of the Stone Raiders had been training with the Exdars,
or using their connections to get into places they wanted to train. As time had gone on, the Eggsdars had stopped being just regular players and started to become another clan of E-heads. They were able to trade gold and other items directly for money, giving them a comfortable lifestyle on Earth, enough to afford pods. Hell, a number of them shared the same facility as Josh. Josh's pensive frown turned to a smile.
Hell, I already think of you lot as part of the guild anyway. I'll leave it up to you two to work out the details.
Josh stood and moved to Florence with his hand outstretched. Excited whispers and murmurs passed through the room. Florence stood, finding Josh pulling her into a hug.
"Welcome to the Stone Riders," he said.
"Thanks." Florence laughed as others whistled and cheered.
"Now, I've got a damned housing complex to clear out. Unless you have something else for me, I'll get going," Josh said.
"See you later. I'll get Susie. She's better at this whole side of things," Lucy said. Josh disappeared from the guild hall and went back to his bedroom. He stood and stretched, waking up fully. He sighed and rubbed his face. He had been in talks with Cassia about having the Golden Sabres join the Stone Raiders in an alliance, but it became clear that they hadn't recovered from the betrayal of so many within their ranks. Josh knew that it would be just a matter of weeks until the guild would dissolve. He didn't know what they were going to do, but he did know that Cassie and her trusted personal friends were looking to join the Stone Raiders. Guilds were falling and rising across Emerillia, many of them claiming to be the most powerful, and Josh was looking forward to proving them all wrong. A proud smile grew across his face as he moved to the shower in his room. His guild had grown. It wasn't massive, like many other guilds, just under 300 members. Nearly all of them were now E-heads. This had become their world in a way that Earth had never been. He only had to look at Dwayne and Lucy's lieutenants, Jules and Essa. Jules didn't have legs back on Earth. Essa was barely making ends meet. Now, they were both within E-head facilities, fully paid for and provided for by their in-game transactions. Emerillia had become their lives. It was what had pushed Cassie and Josh apart. Being in an E-head facility, the pods they lived in would look after their body's needs, thus not needing to log out for weeks instead of hours. Cassie, however, had just the regular headset, meaning every 8 hours in real life or 24 hours in Emerillia, she had to log off. She was also supported by streams and her own brand she had built up with playing other video games, taking her to meetings and events away from Emerillia. She was one of the best fighters, and people paid a ton to see her fight and ogle her. Josh just wanted to live his life here and be left alone by the world. Cassie wanted to tell the world about their relationship, but Josh didn't want to. He didn't want to be dragged away from his new life, to go to the same conferences, banquets, dances, and events that he had become wrapped up in as an investment banker. Cassie saw that coming to the Stone Raiders would let her keep playing in a powerful guild. Josh made it clear that although people could sell some of their videos, there would be times that things would be guild business only. The Stone Raiders were fine with this, as they made enough from the loot that they were selling that they were well supported on Earth. Josh was not looking forward to talking to Cassie about not selling her footage because of the sensitive nature of the quests with the Aleph, demons, and Beastkin if she joined them. The Beastkin and demons were stronger than ever, but they still needed time to get themselves settled in, to meet anything that might threaten them. The Aleph? Well, the Aleph hadn't said a damn thing. Dave had told Josh that they had returned in a private message, but it seemed that they were content to keep to themselves as the Stone Raiders cleared out and repaired their homes. As they went along, they were given resources per clearing out each area. Josh pulled up the quest log. Quest: Aleph Homecoming. You have restored an Aleph city to full functionality and returned it to its original owners. Other locations have been made available to you. Based on the power supplied to the teleport pads, you can travel to the following locations. 1. Aleph Portal Factory. Ability to fix portals in different locations. 1. Aleph Greenhouse. access to herbs and food. 2, Aleph mining facilities. Repairs continue at faster rate. 1, Aleph college. Knowledge on the Aleph areas you will be entering and different systems to repair. 1, Aleph housing complex. Increases in all areas. 3, Aleph forges. Access to weapons, upgrades, and automatons to buy for your own use. Rewards, unknown. Still, the rewards remained a mystery. The Aleph College was nothing that they had been expecting. The entire place was one massive, scaled dungeon. It was half the size of the city Josh was standing in, but it had all manner of experiments that the Aleph had been working on, and that had been altered with time. He needed Dave to check over the remaining facilities since the repair bots would take weeks to finish the work. After finding out about the Aleph Engineer class, the crafters were pouring all their time into learning from Dave, and working on the various facilities, yet there were still problems that they couldn't understand. Dealing with the portal factories was largely left to Dave and Malsor. Crafters went with them, but the concepts were too advanced. Only a few were able to understand the two as they worked. To get the portal factories operational, they would need to clear out the college. Although Malsor and Dave could access a wide variety of information through their librarian necklaces, there were some records and materials that were too valuable to be kept as anything but hard copies. Therefore, capturing the college was a necessity, one that would challenge them like nothing before. Josh turned off the shower and dried off, looking at himself in the mirror.
Ah, looking good, mate.
He made a pistol with his hand and pointed it at himself. His thin frame now had corded muscles covering it. He snorted at his own antics. Putting the towel down, he hotkeyed his normal gear. Leather clothes as black as night appeared. A hood that created shadows over the face, only allowing one's eyes to be visible, not dissimilar to the hoods that Party Zero wore, lay behind his head. He checked the two demon's blades in the small of his back, and a familiar thrill filled him as his eyes turned black for a slight moment. The weapons were incredible, allowing him to cover himself in shadows. The more he killed with the blades, the faster he became. After a period of not being sated, the speed decreased back to normal. It was one hell of a rush. After checking his throwing blades and the modified crossbow on his back, Josh headed out of the room. The hall had stone raiders throughout it. They nodded and greeted him, some talking, others returning from their work, or going out to it. Josh meandered through, headed to where Kim was practicing different artillery spells with a few of her casters, as well as showing other classes how to cast simple spells. Amarillia rewarded those who focused on one class. But everyone was capable of casting magic and fighting with melee weapons.
How are the trainees doing?
Josh walked over to her.
Good. They're barely trainees anymore. Everyone has at least an understanding of magic. Most are using it for enhancing their fighting styles.
Looks like we're going to have a whole bunch of spell swords, Kim said. Well, that is sure to scare the hell out of some people.
Josh grinned. Kim rolled her eyes, and the corners of her mouth lifted up slightly.
So, when are we going to clear out that housing complex?
Once we have all of the other facilities cleared out, then we can deal with it.
I'm guessing we're leaving the Aleph College for last?
Kim looked to Josh.
Yeah, that place is huge, and the Scout Guardians did not make it look simple.
Josh shook his head.
What made you think that?
Was it the level 350 Archlich? Or the level 200-plus helpers?
Maybe the fact that he has been inside the largest repository of magical artifacts and information outside of Peyrouche for centuries?
That might have been a factor.
Do we still have no idea where its damned soul box is?
You mean the phylactery?
Yeah.
No, we don't have any idea.
Josh sighed.
I really hope that Shard wasn't right this one time. How the hell could the Archlich make the entire college its lair?
Don't know. But it would explain how it is able to find even the Scout Guardians. I'm going to get some breakfast, and then check on the other facilities. Make sure that everyone is rotating. I know we've been down here a while, but I want everyone rested and ready before we head into the housing complex.
Will do. See you later. Kim waved Josh off as she headed back out into her training square to educate her trainees. Josh shuddered, thinking about the housing complex. I friggin' hate spiders.
Chapter 4 Future Challenges.
Al-Kao looked to the two councils. The leading council of 10, with 7 demons and 3 beastkin members, and the governing council. The governing council also had 10 leaders, broken down into one elected leader for each region in the Devil's Crater. Farms, city, forest, hunting regions, orchard, and crafters. Then another for each military segment, magical, soldiering, and archer corps, with a final trading leader. The leading council made the major decisions, much like a president or prime minister back on Earth. The governing council looked to support the people, make and uphold laws, and do the best for those they represented. There were 6 different brigades made up of 50,000 soldiers each, with nearly 200,000 beastkin and demons, who weren't in the Devil's Crater Army, or DCA. 20 people to try to guide the future of just over 500,000 demons and beastkin. Al-Kao kept his nerves from showing as he opened the meeting.
How are we looking with the farm's harvest?
Al-Kao asked. It wasn't official, but he seemed to have held the position as the leader of both demons and beastkin. He saw more than one calculating look from both races. In their eyes, he still had to prove himself.
The farm's harvest has been better than I hoped. With the aid of the army, we are well ahead of schedule. We're storing and preparing the foodstuffs, but we're going to need to expand our storage facilities,
a white tiger beastkin said.
Good. If there are earth or dark mages and builders free, see if they can help. Food for the coming winter is our top priority,
Al-Kao said, holding the beastkin's eyes.
I will see to it, Prince Al-Kao.
The beastkin nodded. Good.
How about the orchards?
Al-Kao's gaze rested on a rabbit beastkin.
We're going to need help bringing in our harvest. It won't be much, but it should help out. We've been building the greenhouses, but they are expensive due to the cost of clear glass. Some of the blacksmiths and other crafters have been working with glass silicate to try to make it cheaper. The way it looks, we might have one full-length greenhouse ready before month's end, when winter will really kick in.
How many supplies will we need to get for the oncoming winter?
Al-Kao asked. The beastkin, representing farms, looked to the rabbit beastkin who ran the orchards.
I'm not sure. We have enough for 3, maybe 4 months with all of the supplies we have stacked up. I don't know what that would be like if we were to do army operations,
the farm's beastkin said. The orchard's beastkin nodded in agreement.
If I may, the beastkin trader raised his hand.
Al-Kao waved for him to go on.
We have 2 months for the beastkin and demon population if we use the foodstuffs already stored and estimated to come in, if we are to fight. If we weren't, then we would have 4 months. This does not take into account how much meat we can get from the beasts in the hunting area, or from clearing out the different areas of the crater,
the trader finished. Al-Kao nodded and turned away from the elk beastkin.
I wonder if he eats meat.
Al-Kao pondered his options.
The going rate for the rare beasts we are killing in this area should help with the costs of foodstuffs. I will have a talk with Dave to see if he might have a way of making the greenhouses glass. We need more wood for heating the homes of the different settlements and the keeps. I want to get a group of our scouts watching the oncoming demon horde. As they grow closer, we will start using the new tactics we have learned. Any forces that are not working with the villagers to harvest will be sent out in patrols to familiarize themselves with the area, gather herbs and edibles, as well as start to make traps for the oncoming soulless demons. I want the forests and plains filled with physical and magical traps.
I know that we can get weapons from the trading terminal, but I want our blacksmiths working as hard as possible to make weapons and armor. We're going to need our coin to buy foodstuffs. We should also get different units patrolling the untamed areas of the crater, clearing out unwanted beasts,